Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel. Thanks so much for joining us. I want to remind you, it's book season at Baseball America. The ultimate 2012 Baseball America reference books will be available soon. Get your copies while supplies last. You can choose them on the Prospect Handbook, the 2012 Almanac, our directory, the Draft Almanac, the Super Register. They're all available at baseballamerica.com/store. JJ, the almanac is in its death throes. We're finishing that.
Not death throes. It's in its, we're finishing it off.
We're finishing it.
Death throes, hey, with a book like that and what's happened with other books like that, you don't want to say death throes. We're continuing to do the almanac.
I mean, the 2012 almanac is in its death throes. I'm ready for that thing to be done.
Yeah.
And I think we are all ready for that to be out the door. But yes, it's still a viable product, unlike many of its predecessors. Love the almanac. Once it's done, because it is the kind of book that I read my old almanacs. You know, I actually do.
If you want to know what happened in baseball in 2011, that's the book to have.
And at all levels, and every drafted player signed.
Yeah, that almanac really is a book that actually gets, in some ways, almost even more and more interesting as the years go on. We pull ours out here in the office a lot of times. Like, we'll be talking about something. It's like, well, let's look in the 1995 almanac, and we'll pull it out and take a look at.
I always love looking back.
Who was the best guys in the, you know, who should we have ranked in the top 20 that year?
I love looking back at those for, like, JUCO stats. Like, oh, this guy was one of the top JUCO guys. You know, that kind of stuff, it sticks out. But the other, of course, other book that we're working on feverishly at this time of year is the Prospect Handbook. And when it's Prospect Handbook season, that means it's top 10 season. So we're going to talk the next few podcasts. With some exceptions, we're going to talk top 10 prospects. It's National League East top 10 prospects. Well, they're all online.
We'll have some additional prospect podcasts in addition to that. We're going to have a draft podcast this week with Connor and Nathan talking about the high school top 100.
And we'll have another draft podcast as Jim Callis, when it's handbook season. Jim Callis comes down a couple times for the handbook to help edit it on site, and he will be here later this week. And as the CBA negotiations are very close, JJ, and I say kudos to Major League Baseball and the Players Association for keeping it quiet. But there have been some leaks, and there are going to be some significant changes to the draft, and Jim and I, and you will probably all talk about that in a podcast later this week. But we're going to do at least one podcast for every division. There might be a division where we decide to be an organization just too interesting or that kind of thing where we break it up. But you can plan on an NL East, an NL Central, an NL West,
and the same
podcast here in the off season at Baseball America. So JJ, let's kick off the National League East. First and foremost, let's rank the top 10s. And we don't have the whole top 30s in hand right here, but just ranking the top 10s, how would you rank them in this division?
Nats are number one.
I think so as well.
I don't think there's really that. I think the Nationals are clear number one. The Braves are not that. The Braves, at the top of the Braves, the top three on the Braves, I think, I might even say I'd probably rather have the Braves top three, even with Bryce Harper being number one, than the Nationals not top three.
You would or you would not?
I would.
Wow. I'm not with you on that.
But the Braves list drops off much quicker than the Nationals list. The reason I say this, again, we'll get to that. We'll explain that when we get to the Nationals.
I know why. I know why. But
your Braves top three, Teherán, Vizcaíno, Delgado. I think those are three very solid, nearly at least. Well, those are
all
three
of them have big league
with big league experience.
Any organization would like to have their top three prospects be young power arm pitchers who already have a smidge of big league experience. There's no downside there.
Not only a smidge, but like in Randall Delgado's case, seven starts and seven good starts.
Yeah, he was very good. He was better than I thought.
And that's the number three prospect.
Yeah, absolutely. No, he'd be number one in a lot of organizations.
But that being said, the Braves list, there's a pretty significant gap. Randall Delgado's number three. And we're going to talk about, that's a top 100 guy and all. Obviously, don't hold us. Top 100's a long ways away.
Yeah.
But those are three guys who are clearly top 100 guys.
Those are top 100 guys. Randall Delgado might have the skinniest head of any top 100
yes,
guy.
But
yeah, those are all top 100 guys.
Number four, Anderton Simmons. Number five, Sean Gilmartin.
I think Anderton Simmons is the top 100 guy because you're going to get bonus points for shortstop, but it might cut off right there.
And I think that there's going to be a pretty significant gap when we do our top 100 between where you see Delgado in that list and Simmons.
I don't disagree with you at all. And there's intrigue in the rest of that top 10, JJ, but And there's, you know, there's more close to the majors help with a guy like Pastrnicki. I mean, it wouldn't shock me if Tyler Pastrnicki were there starting shortstop next year. I know we're kind of getting into the Braves here instead of going ranking the teams, but that's fine with me.
Sorry, we're jumping around. This is their podcast. That's how we do
that's
it.
That's right.
But that kind of, I mean, but that sums up also, the Braves have some interesting decisions to make going forward. They've already made one, which we expected, which was Derek Lowe is no longer a Brave. And
that decision was, I think they made the decision, but that was easier than I think they thought it probably would be. That was pretty good.
Yeah, it was easier that they could find someone to take $5 million of his contract.
That's it. And that's, you know, they're still paying a lot of money to get rid of Derek Lowe, but that could be win-win as far as the Braves deleting Derek Lowe. I think it's for the Indians, it's a good $5 million flyer to take, you know, on a veteran pitcher like that who's – I still think there's something left in the tank with Derek Lowe. You know, we'll see. I'm
Derek
in the minority.
Lowe. Yeah, you're a Derek –
I've long been a Derek Lowe guy. So.
You know, I I'm not as much a Derek Lowe guy. So I can't – at $5 million, the one thing I'll say is that if he's not, he won't be pitching for them by midseason.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. No,
I mean,
that's
not, a good
way to put
it. You don't
want
to spend $5 million on a pitcher, but you don't. You're not going to let him go out there and have a 5.5 ERA for 15 starts and say,
right.
You know what? Here's another 15. Let's see how it goes.
You do kind of wonder about an infield of Laporta, Kipnis, Cabrera, and Chisenhall. Is that right side of that infield going to be good enough for guys going to be getting all those ground balls? That I do wonder that fit. And the Indians are such a ground ball heavy staff. Anyway, so I do wonder about that part, but I think when you have a young pitching staff and a young team like that, I think it makes sense to give Derek Lowe a whirl. But back to the Braves.
For the Braves, it makes sense because Derek Lowe would at best probably have been their eighth best pitcher this year, starting pitcher.
Right. I mean, now with their top, now I think we both expect Julio Teheran is going to – at the big league level, there's Hudson, for now, Jarred Jurgens, Tommy Hansen, Brandon Beachy, Mike Minor, Julio Teheran, Randall Delgado. Am I leaving somebody out?
And
I guess
then,
the rehabbing Chris Medlin, who's probably going to go to the bullpen.
And then your other question is Vizcaíno a starter or a reliever?
I think when you line up those other eight guys, I think
right
Vizcaíno's in the bullpen.
Reliever.
I think he's in the bullpen. You know, and then the question there is,
and then
will Freddie Gonzalez overuse him? Because he's been fragile in the past. And Freddie Gonzalez overused the big leaguers they had there this year. There's no question about it. So.
And I'll say this. If he overuses them next year, it really will be a case of there will be no excuse because
right.
That's where this Braves team looks very interesting is that you'll have – if Vizcaíno goes to the pen, Vizcaíno's ready for – if he's going to go to the pen, he's ready to be in the big leagues.
He's ready for important innings. It looks
right.
Like. He's ready for high-leverage innings.
Okay. So you have – if that's the case, you take what they already had, the big three they had this year. Then you bring in Vizcaíno.
Right.
J.J. Hoover looks like he's
close to being
close
ready.
To being ready.
Christian Martinez is an interesting arm. So, I mean, I guess you try to divest yourself of Scott Linebrink if he's not already a free agent as
right.
soon as possible.
That's a whole lot of intriguing arms for that pen.
No doubt.
I mean,
no
that's,
doubt.
That's very – that's where the Braves – and we just talked about it. The Braves have some other decisions to make because – that's a whole lot of intriguing arms they have. Almost more.
Almost too many.
The depth they have means that at the start of the season, without any trades, you just mentioned it. There's a very good chance that if they didn't make any trades, they're going to make some more trades. But if they didn't, Teheran, Delgado head back to AAA because why not get them some more innings in AAA? Not that they really necessarily need them.
Right.
But if you've got everyone else is healthy from that rotation, who was your rotation at the end of the year?
You'd rather have them taking a turn every 5 days in Gwinnett than getting possibly overused by Freddie Gonzalez or just languishing and not developing in a big league bullpen.
But that being said, someone else who's more expensive is going to be moved, and it does seem like Jarred Jurgens is the guy who's most likely to be that guy.
And that makes sense. I mean, he's marketable. He's not shown a great recent track record of durability. I think it makes sense for the Braves to have at least a couple guys in reserve because Tommy Hansen didn't make it through the whole season. Tim Hudson's, what, 36, 37 years old now? I think you do want to have – it's important for them to have depth and to have extra pitchers, but guess what? They do. And there's, you know, later on guys down the line, like a guy like a Sean Gilmartin or Zeke Sproul. I mean, Sproul, it's not inconceivable that Sproul, who made seven starts in Double-A this year, if you need an emergency start out of him in 2012 – that he could be
capable
of making one.
It's no less inconceivable than Tehran, who came up relatively early in the year for them last year.
Right. And then I like Tyler Pastrnicki, JJ, and I think it depends on what the rest of the Braves offseason looks like. And I guess the Braves really kind of have to assess what Jason Hayward they're going to have in 2012. Is it going to be somewhere in between 2010 and 11? You know, what kind of Jason Hayward shows up? I think there's a sliding scale. I mean, Alex Gonzalez gave them power and, I guess, a veteran defensive presence. I don't think Pastrnicki's upside is as high as Gonzalez's is in terms of defense. But
and by
I
you mean the defense that you saw from him back
Gonzalez
when he
was at his best. Yeah, when he was at his best, I don't think Tyler Pastrnicki ever be a premium defender at shortstop.
No.
But I think he could be a capable one at shortstop. And the question is, can the Braves be just capable? Because you know they're just capable at second base in Dan Uggla, and they're just capable at third base with Chipper Jones. So at some point or somewhere along the line, you want good, not just capable. On defense. So that's, I think, the questions for Pastrnicki. And the Braves have to do.
Anderson
they
Simmons,
can't just evaluate
who's still
him.
A ways away, is good.
You know,
the question of him is will he be capable at the plate?
You know, I it's funny you mentioned him. I just remember this conversation. I went to the Rising Stars game in Arizona, which was a blast, and talked to Joe Tardasovich, who did not make this top 10. I'm a little bit surprised he didn't in some ways, especially if watching him just drop the bat hit on that home running off Garrett Cole. I mean, he really showed pretty sick power. But I talked to him briefly in BP about Anderson Simmons, and he just said, like, that guy was so far and away better than the other shortstops he's seen in pro ball. And then he said that the only reason that guy makes errors is that he's convinced he can make every play.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a guy who does have ceiling defensively, better really even, I think, than Alex Gonzalez.
Oh, yeah.
And the fact that he won the batting title in the Carolina League makes me think that the guy will hit enough to be a regular.
Right. And
I don't think he's going to be impact.
And the thing you've got to remember is if you're listening to this, rescale your expectations
right.
for shortstops. We're not in the era of the 20 home run, you know, shortstop who also plays solid above average defense.
Yeah, there's one of those guys now. They're not like six.
Right.
There's one.
And there's a whole lot of guys who, if you hit an empty 300 in the big leagues and play very good defense, that's going to have value.
Yeah,
and
I mean...
I know there's some people who are going to think, it doesn't have that much value because all the value is tied up the batting average. If you play above-average defense and can do anything at the plate,
right,
you're going to have value because that's the era we're back in.
I think you look at your playoff teams this year, JJ, and you had in the American League, you had a team that had a complete zero at shortstop in the Rays, basically. Reed Brignac was horrible this year, and Sean Rodriguez was a platoon player. You had two teams in the Yankees and Tigers who were – basically going for all offense at shortstop. Derek Jeter had a great second half for the Yankees, but the Yankees have known that he's a below-average defender for a long time. But he can still hit. And Johnny Peralta is an offense-first guy in Detroit. He basically had one team in Texas that had a defense-first shortstop who also gives you some offensive production. Elvis Andrews, who has very little power, was really the only two-way shortstop in the American League playoff teams.
He's a guy whose value's tied in his average, and he runs.
Yeah, he walks a little bit. He runs, right. He handles the bat. He really probably shouldn't hit two-hole, but whatever.
Yeah, you probably also wouldn't bat the best guy hitter in the AL over the second half of the season.
Exactly. And in the National League, you know, Rafael Furcal, you know, the certainly passed his prime, but was productive for St. Louis. But St. Louis, you know, one of the reasons they were struggling and were not going to make the playoffs the first half of the year.
But they were
horrible at shortstop, just horrible.
But that sums up what we're talking about. There are playoff teams who had gaping holes at shortstop.
Yeah.
Anderson Simmons,
right.
If he continues to develop, will not be a gaping hole.
No, absolutely. I agree. He will not be a gaping hole. He should be a bottom of the lineup hitter.
Right.
But his defense is going to be first division, top of the first division defense potentially at shortstop.
With an arm that's like, when you talk about Furcal, with a Furcal-esque arm.
But you look at the rest of the National League, and the Diamondbacks. You know, Stephen Drew, tools-wise, is a first division, you know, top-shelf shortstop, but he's hurt. So they go with Johnny McDonald and Willie Bloomquist at shortstop. Arizona does down the stretch, and they played great down the stretch, pulled away. This is why Jimmy Rollins is a valuable player. And then, of course, the Brewers, 96 wins with Yunesky Betancourt at shortstop. If you have a good enough other team, you can make up for these things. But we're just trying to point out that not a lot of profile shortstops out there. Anderson Simmons is going to be – I think he has supreme value. But I do think, for me, if I'm evaluating the Braves, I think Tyler Pastrnicki's, even with as good as other pitchers are, I think he's most likely to be a rookie who makes impact next year, just because I think he can be a good, cheap, everyday shortstop that helps you address. He's a low-cost player and capable, and he allows you to do other things, other positions on your roster. So and for me, he'd be my if I were the Braves, he'd be my starting shortstop next year.
Right, and the only question becomes, will there be the opportunity for him?
Right, absolutely. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the now Miami Marlins. And I think they're the number five org for me. Number five, top 10.
I think we agree on that.
In the National League East. Now, last night, as we record this on a Monday, Sunday night, we had Christian Yelich on our Sirius XM show, and he was good. Talked at length about his throwing motion, and when we mentioned that we had Christian Yelich on the show today, Nathan Rohde said his throwing motion is really messed up. I mean, like, it's like we're obsessing about
this a little
bit. Christian
Yelich says, "Yes, I know, I've heard this."
He's heard it, and it doesn't seem to matter. And when you hit, the way he did with his swing and with his, he's got power, he's got speed, he's got hitting ability, he's athletic, and he's playing up the middle in center field. JJ, to me, Christian Yelich is a very representative, a very strong number one prospect.
I have no problem. Number one, number two on this list.
Yeah,
no problems at all. And number two is a high risk, high reward, but that's high reward.
Yeah,
Marcell Ozuna.
Yeah, some of the people we talked to this year talked about, you're throwing 80 power on this guy, you're throwing 70 throwing arm on this guy. He's a prototype right field profile. He's not Mike Stanton. I don't think he'll ever be Mike Stanton, but yeah, that's what makes him Mike Stanton, but the rest of this top 10.
He only hit 23 home runs in Greensboro. He didn't hit, was it 36?
I think Mike Stanton would hit 23 like in 2 months in Greensboro. But the rest of the top 10, you have a first round pick. Their last two first round picks, I should say, or two of their last three in Fernandez and Chad James. Young pitchers. Chad James, who had, better than a 5-15 season, but still not great.
Better than a 5-15. At the same time, you give up 173 hits and 150 innings in the Florida State League. That's not a great year.
I agree.
That's not missing a whole lot of bats. That's getting squared up some.
He is. And then, I like Rob Rasmussen. I'm not a big Matt Dominguez guy. I'm intrigued by guys like JT Realmuto and Noah Perio. But, JJ, this is probably a three guys at most on the top 100, at most.
I don't think Jose Fernandez is making it.
Yeah.
I don't think that you're not talking there.
We usually don't put 15 draft guys, I don't think, in the top 100.
Especially when you're talking about guys before the draft, you say, that guy's clearly going to make the top 100. He wasn't a guy who was good.
Can't remember where he was in our top 200. I think it was inside the top 25. I mean, he is pretty interesting. He's a physical prep right-hander.
But he's a physical prep right-hander. Usually those guys, if you're not the – there are a couple of prep right-handers.
You're not Dylan Bundy.
You're not Dylan Bundy, those kind of guys.
Archie
Bradley, who was considered the class of that group. We at least wait. We want to see you actually make a start every fifth day and how you handle it.
You're right. He's probably not going to be in the top 100. And the rest of the a guy like Adam Conley, I think we like Adam Conley at number 10, but he could be a lefty reliever. And there's a lot of relievers when you look overall in this organization's top 30. There's a lot of relief pitchers.
Scott Cousins, number 9. The reality of it is that he's probably a fourth outfielder.
Yeah.
A useful fourth outfielder. And he's big league ready as a fourth outfielder. But at the same time, there aren't a whole lot of fourth outfielders in top 10s.
No, and for me, the most interesting player in the list, besides Yelich and Ozuna, is Realmuto. Just because he's a guy who was a highly touted high school quarterback. Obviously, football's a big deal in the state of Oklahoma. A guy who also didn't catch a lot in high school, now full-time catcher with some offensive ability. I think he hit a home run off Steven Strasburg, if memory serves, when Strasburg was rehabbing in the South Atlantic League. So just like a guy who's got some power, got some athletic ability, interesting conversion guy.
Right, and we'll have to see, the thing about it is I would argue Realmuto is what the Marlins hoped they were getting in Skipworth and never got.
Yeah.
He's a third-round pick. Skipworth was a first-round pick. But the reality is Realmuto has showed more offensive potential already than Skipworth has during his career. And defensively, there are the tools there for Realmuto to be maybe better defense,
I think he'll be at least as good defensively. I mean, it's funny, after seeing Skipworth in the fall league, you can see why he was the 6th overall pick. Just if you just look at him, he's big, but not too big. Left-handed hitter. He's hit for some power in the minor leagues, but it just really hasn't come together for Kyle Skipworth. That's a draft pick that it just didn't work out. You're looking back on that one. I think that was the same.
Catchers sometimes take a little while, but it's 2008. I mean, you're
At some
point you have to start seeing some. Yeah,
I think we know that this is not going to be a guy who's going to fulfill the ceiling of being picked in the first 10 overall picks in the draft. But the Marlins. It's funny they hit Southern California as hard as any organization. Yelich is a SoCal guy. Matt Dominguez is a SoCal guy. Rob Rasmus is a SoCal guy. Scott Cousins is actually a NorCal guy. And then Noah Perio. I mean, it's they hit, and then of course Mike Stanton. They hit Southern California as hard as any organization does.
As far as talking about the organization and their direction, now fascinating direction that they're going in as an organization. We'll see what happens with it.
They've gone on the indie ball direction on the minor league level with Marty Scott as their farm director.
Right.
They acknowledge that their farm system has gone the wrong direction and that they need to do a better job developing players, and they made a change in their minor league department this year.
At the big league level, they're trying to make as much noise as they can that this is a different Marlins team, new ballpark,
new uniforms,
and new free agents.
And new manager, obviously, in Ozzie Guillen, and he's really the magnet to allow them to go court these players like a Jose Reyes. One of the tweets I saw the day from a South Florida writer was that he is central to all their offseason plans, Jose Reyes. And I guess there was a report over the weekend that deal was already done. That was obviously premature at best, wrong at worst. But I don't know, JJ, just how much can a few free agent signings change? It would be pretty dynamic to have Jose Reyes and Hanley Ramirez on the left side of the infield.
Right. This doesn't feel like a team that's a player or two away.
Exactly. I agree with you.
Especially because their core. Now, the thing I'll say for him is you do have in Stanton, you have a very young top player.
Right.
But Hanley Ramirez is getting, he's getting older and more expensive. He is more expensive. He's expensive. Reyes would be expensive. You can't knock it that if the Marlins add Reyes, that makes them better defensively at shortstop. Ramirez can play multiple other positions where he would be fine.
One would assume.
Yeah, one would think. Yeah. I mean, I remember that there was time, talk back when he was still in the minors. It's like, this guy may be a future stud center fielder.
Right, right.
But it does, you still have a lot of the same question marks, and I don't know, it really kind of, I don't know how those get fixed, because there's not really, if you look at it, like you look at this top 10, you can argue that Dominguez, okay, maybe he's ready, to come up, but when we talk about Anderton Simmons being a bottom of the order hitter, Matt Dominguez is...
That's a good comparison.
Matt Dominguez, actually, though, I'll say this, that fits. Now, if they sign Reyes and they move Hanley, they're either moving to third or to center.
Right.
In that case, if he's in center and Reyes is at short, that's the perfect team to have Matt Dominguez as your third baseman.
Yeah.
He'll play gold glove third base,
right,
and you're basically saying, okay, our shortstop will produce as a third baseman,
right,
and our third baseman will produce as a shortstop.
Yeah, that makes some sense. It would be interesting to see Hanley at this stage of his career, as big as he is, playing center field. To me, you just don't want that guy running around that much at that size at this stage of his career.
He might slim down a little bit by doing it.
That's true. That's true. But that's gotta be hard on the knees. No matter what free agents they sign, to me, their team is still going to be tied to. Is Josh Johnson healthy? Yes or no? And if he's not, they just don't have the pitching without him. If they do, you have a rare number one starter. To me, that makes all the difference. This is already more Marlins than I think I've ever talked.
So,
they just don't interest me. I don't know what it is. Well, I mean, maybe it's the South Florida part of it, having lived there. But
we want to cover them extensively, each team.
That was extensive.
If you're a fan of a team, we're going to give you at least about 10 minutes, hopefully, on your team.
The Marlins, but that's the thing. It's surprising that they have drafted pitchers high, but they've done that for like 6, 7, 8 years. But that 2005 draft, they've acknowledged
didn't work out
for them. They're still kind of Chris Volstad's the best of that lot, and he still hasn't really.
They've given up. They've given up. I mean,
he's out of the organization. Taylor Tanker, they've drafted pitchers with their first pick in 2004, 2005, 2006. and then 2009 and then 2011. So it's not because they haven't tried. But outside of Josh Johnson, they're homegrown pitchers. You know, the rest of the other pitchers are guys who came over in Trey Anibal Sanchez and Ricky Nolasco. So it's surprising that they've struggled that much to develop pitching after finding Josh Johnson back in the 02 draft. It's been a long time since they drafted successfully.
Speaking of teams that are trying to find their way,
yeah.
The New York Mets.
That's a good way to put it. They are trying to find their way. J.J., you know, and now they have a one-year scouting director, Chad McDonald, gone from the organization, gone to the San Diego Padres. Tommy Tanus, I think is how you pronounce his last name, is the new scouting director. I just talked to a Mets scout last week a little bit about Tommy. And, yeah, he doesn't see their organization's philosophy changing that much, but there's just a lot of change going on with the Mets, and they're probably going to lose Jose Reyes. They'll probably trade David Wright, it sounds like. This team, offensively, was actually pretty good. Matt Eddy with the stat of the year for me in their overview. They outscored the Phillies. Even though the Phillies hit like 45 more home runs than the Mets, and you think of the Mets as like Citi Field is kind of like a Petco Park Part 2, well, at least the Padres play to that park. They don't score, but they pitch pretty well. They were third in the National League in ERA. The Mets were like 11th, even in Citi Field. So to their credit, and the Mets have concentrated their focus on arms and getting Zach Wheeler, Matt Harvey in last year's draft, Wheeler this year in the Beltran trade. That's a pretty good power arm duo. I'm just thinking of the other National League teams we've already done, really the Braves and the Cardinals, the only ones that are comparable with Shelby Miller and Carlos Martinez in St. Louis.
Better.
Better, I agree. And then you know, what we just talked about in Atlanta, which is also better because they've got big league experience with Teron, Vizcaíno,
right,
and Delgado.
No, Wheeler Harvey, you're not going to...
Wheeler Harvey's pretty good.
And especially, you are talking about a guy who's in high A last year and a guy who's in double A. You're not talking about guys who are, you know, we're not talking about a Jose Fernandez. We're talking about, well,
right.
You know, let's see how many... Made a start every fifth day.
Right, or a guy like a James who hasn't gotten out of A-ball and really hasn't had a ton of success in the minor leagues yet.
Right, but I think the top end of this list, I think you can even say Brandon Nimmo is a very interesting number three. Ideally, in a better organization, he's a number five prospect, maybe number four.
Yep.
But he's not embarrassing. There are some organizations where he'd be number one.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think Matt Harvey would be number one in a lot of organizations. Those two guys, to me, are pretty interchangeable. There's a dime's worth of difference between Harvey and Zach Wheeler. For me, the Mets list falls apart after number five. I like Cesar Puello, Henry Mejia. I like Henry Mejia as well, but injured this year, so there's a question mark there. Then you get to Kirk Neuenhaus, who's a little more of an extra guy, although maybe he's a second division center fielder. Then you have a high school pitcher from this year's draft, Michael Fulmer, off the injured Rhys Havens. And then the guy we probably could spend a lot of time talking about, JJ's, Wilmer Flores. Sneaks onto the list at number 10. It's the second time in the last 5 or 6 years the Mets have had a prospect who bursts on the scene, hits at the lower levels, is very young for his age, and then just seems to stop making progress. And Fernando Martinez is, to me, does Fernando Martinez's track record affect how you view Wilmer Flores? It does me.
I don't know if it does. I've just been off the Wilmer Flores train before I would kind of
before it left the station.
Before it left the station. Like, I wonder with guys like that, are you retarding their development? Because it's almost like, and this is a bad analogy, I'll warn everyone right now, but you can't teach calculus to someone who hasn't learned algebra. You're talking about the Mets have this history of pushing guys so fast that it's almost you throw them in the lake, and if they sink, then, well, they couldn't make it. And if they swim, hey, great. You know,
it's like the Detroit Tigers approach, but the Tigers, simply they do it with toolsier guys. The Mets have done it with guys who can hit, but their other tools aren't great. And that was the case with Fernando Martinez, and that's the case with Wilmer Flores. He doesn't run. And I guess the real problem, JJ, is finding a profile that Wilmer Flores fits, because he can hit, but the power hasn't shown up yet. And yeah, he's young, but at some point, when do you stop saying that? You know, he's 20 years old. That's awfully young.
I've heard 20s on his speed.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No doubt. No.
I don't know.
He's not an athlete.
I do not know.
Yeah.
If I can name you another shortstop in the minors with 20 speed.
Yeah, he's not an athletic guy. I said he's not an athlete, but you just don't get any positive reports about his level of athletic ability.
And that's not his fault.
Right. That's just who
but
he is.
I don't understand. I understand that, like, the theory of you keep a guy at a position for as long as you can and then you move him off of it. But in Flores' case, there's a lot of demands that come with being a shortstop also. I do wonder if put him at a little bit easier position, would that help his offense kind of take off a little bit too?
Yeah.
Because his offense has not really shown any significant improvement in the last couple
years. No, he doesn't
draw
a lot of walk and doesn't hit for a lot of power. I think there's a chance the power could come, but it's going to have to for him to be an everyday regular. That's why we have him in the top 10, because there's still a chance that power could come. But it might have to be at first base. It probably won't be left field. Really, JJ, what you're saying is let's put this guy at third base now. Find out if he can play third base.
We still have to see if he can play that.
And that's where you're – to me, part of the reason that you push these guys to such advanced levels at young ages is you create value for them.
Right.
And it worked with Deolis Guerra. He was part of the package for Johan Santana. But soon, it's almost like if you don't strike while that prospect's –
if you don't manage to trade him, then you're stuck with a less valuable prospect.
That's it. You've devalued him if you don't move him at his peak. And right now, I think he's devalued.
And the thing about it is I don't know if that necessarily works too well. Talking to scouts from other organizations, you'll hear them say it's really hard to get a handle on Mets guys because you see guys, they do it two entirely different ways. You see a lot of Latin guys who are playing way above the level they should be at.
Right.
And you see a lot of polished, especially polished college pitchers and that kind of guys in the Mets organization who are playing way below where they should be playing.
You know who the opposite of Wilmer Flores kind of is, and at the same time like the same guy, is Juan Lagares. I didn't realize that Juan Lagares finished fifth in the minors in batting, hitting .349.
Oh, yeah.
And the 1 year I did the Mets top 30, he was in it. He was number 28 as like a 17-year-old. He was either 17 or 18. He played that year in the Sally League. He played shortstop. Now he's like a lumbering left fielder. But even at that time, we ranked him. He made 42 errors, I think, in 80 games, or 40 errors in 82 games in low A. And he was playing shortstop, and they knew. You read the report, they're like, yeah, he's not a shortstop, but we played him there anyway. And, you know, now you kind of wonder, Juan Lagares is like a guy that other scouts just don't think much about. But to me, there has to be something there. There has to be some athleticism. And he hit .350 for crying out loud, including .370 in double A. He's 22. Is that where Wilmer Flores is headed? Is he headed to Juan Lagaresville? Because I don't think the Mets want that. I don't think they want Juan Lagares in Juan Lagaresville. But it sounds like that's where Wilmer Flores is headed. But because he had hype at one point, tied 100% really to his age, he's a very difficult guy to get a handle on. It would be nice to see him play third base next year, either back in the Florida State League or double A.
But here's the problem.
And see what happens.
Can you put him back in the Florida State League?
Yeah, I don't know. He hit 260, what, 269?
I mean, can you put him back there for year three?
Oh, I forgot that it would be year three. Yeah, probably not.
You can't.
Probably not.
From a player confidence standpoint, you can't say, go on back there. You know, the great thing is you know where all the places to eat are. You know, you got the best parking spot.
You don't want to be the mayor of St. Lucie.
Yeah, you know, and so the other problem the Mets have, though, is that on a broader level, if Reyes leaves, which sure looks like it's going to happen, whether they trade David Wright or not, who's this team built around now?
Oh, I don't know. Dylan G? I don't know. The highest salary player is still Johan Santana.
But the problem for this team is that I don't think you can rebuild in New York like you can in some places. You can't say, look, guys, we're 4 years away.
Well, they're turning into the Dodgers, and it's the similar root cause, which is ownership that was mismanaged the club and mismanaged its own money. So obviously different roots of that with the Wilpons getting caught up in the Madoff stuff.
And you summed up the key thing of that is if I was a Mets fan, the thing that I would be angriest about is that they don't understand the draft.
Yeah, and that's
and
the
that's
thing
not the people. I'm not saying that the people in the Mets organization don't understand the draft.
But that,
I'm
that,
saying
that,
that
came
the
from ownership,
ownership
right.
has not understood the draft.
And this year they did go a little bit out of slot. They were a little bit more aggressive. They took.
But
more
there is no big market team that has done a worse job of understanding how you can
use the draft to take advantage, to basically be the big market team.
Yeah, I mean, they've had, put it this way, that was one of Omar Minaya's larger failings as Mets guy, general manager. He had several, but one of them was they lost a lot of draft picks on to free agent compensation. And then when they did go over slot, it was Mike Pelfrey, who's just been a disappointment, no other way to put it. He's been a reliable, below-average big league starter. I think I saw his best start ever in 2008, the night before the All-Star break. But, you know, other guys they've drafted high, guys like, you know, Eddie Koons and Steven Matz and some of these guys, they didn't draft very well for several years. And they've had some finds in there, Lucas Duda here, Ike Davis there, but no impact really.
And they don't – the thing what I'm saying, though, is go a step further.
Yeah, as far they're as leveraging team, their money. Yeah.
They're the team that does not. The Yankees, the Red Sox, a lot of these other big market teams, they're going to take a 12th rounder or an 18th rounder who they're going to take a run at.
Right.
The Mets don't.
The Mets don't. And they've had a payroll of $100 million or more every year, save one, since 2003. And they don't leverage.
They do it at the big league level.
They do it at the big league level,
but
and they don't
at the same
leagues.
Time.
You're right.
Of their top five club bonuses, you know, bonuses in club history, three of them are from 2005 and before.
Yeah. Yeah. Four of them. Pelfrey, Umber, Kazmir. Oh, Nemo is 2011. I'm sorry. But yeah, no, you're
and,
right.
And when we talk, Brandon Nemo this year signed the fifth largest bonus in team history, 2.1 mil.
Yeah. No, you're right.
That's
surprising.
That's not throwing your weight around.
It is. It would be disappointing to be a Mets fan. We have one in the office, and Matt Eddy is disappointed about their – in fact, I think that they've really kind of beaten the Mets fandom out of it.
But let's ask it so. So where do you slot the Mets as far as
– I slot them four, just ahead of the Marlins. It's,
I agree.
It's close. I think it's really close. And the next club, to me, the Phillies, I give them a three. I rank them third ahead of the Mets because I give them the benefit of the doubt. They developed their pitchers a lot better than the Mets.
Well, not only that, but they've
all their players really
like, and this Phillies list is significantly weaker than it's been.
Absolutely,
but there's an understandable reason it's weaker, which is if you keep trading away prospects to land star big leaguers,
right,
or at least very comfortably, you know, key big leaguers.
Yeah,
that's an understandable use of your farm system.
I'm doing the Astros top 30, and four members of my top 10 are former Phillies in Singleton, Santana, Cozart, and Jonathan Villar. And all those guys would probably rank ahead of Trevor May for me, including Santana. I like Domingo Santana, but
I don't
that's
know if
a
I
whole
go
show.
All four, but yeah, but I'll put it this way. All four of those guys would easily be in the top 10.
Oh, yeah. All four of those guys are ahead of Jesse Biddle for me.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all – I mean, if you put those four guys back in the Phillies farm system, Jesse Biddle is number six at the most, and he's number two without those guys there. And that's not even talking about the guys that traded to the Blue Jays for Halladay, Anthony Goes and Travis d'Arnaud and some of those guys. Anthony Goes, by the way, who is a dead ringer for T-Plush. He is facially – he's skinnier, but he is a dead ringer for Nigel Morgan. And Paul Severino of MLB Network agrees with me. We were at the Rising Stars game. He was like, who is that who looks just like Nigel Morgan? I was like, oh, my gosh. Yeah, I hadn't placed it before.
Let's ask this. If you put together a top 10 of traded to still qualify to be prospects, traded
well,
for the
Kyle
you could put together
doesn't qualify anymore, does he? And
no,
Carlos
he does
Carrasco
not.
Does not.
But you could put together – you just ran off six.
Yeah, well – of the well, I ran off four guys who were traded. Oh, yeah, six. Ghost and d'Arnaud. Who else did the Blue Jays get? Drabeck? That six, there got to be some more in there. Who they
Lou Marson doesn't qualify anymore.
Michael Taylor still qualifies, but I don't think he's a top 10 caliber prospect.
Right, but okay. So it's probably six. It's probably six legit top 10 caliber prospects that they've traded away in the last couple of years.
And you want to talk about a team that has big money that doesn't leverage it in the draft per se. Look at their top five signing bonuses, J.J. They haven't gotten someone to break into that since 2002. Number one, they draft high, but number two, they spread their money around in the draft. Jerry
but
Cozart
you know
was a late. They're
again,
still aggressive.
I was going to say they're aggressive in different way, and
they
I don't.
Are.
I to me, they get it. They just do it a different way, which is they are the masters of. They're a team that knows how to target the not expensive. But, you know, the guy that you throw.
The guy who's fallen but isn't necessarily a seven-figure, eight-figure.
Hey, Trevor May, here's your fourth-round pick. We're going to give you enough money to
bring
you.
Brody Colvin. You know, Brody Colvin, who ranked at the front of these pitchers last year but had really a loss.
Juwan James, who was, you know, we could get you for $150,000 in the 22nd round.
Right, right.
Those kind of guys. They do it. They just do it. They do it on the cheap sometimes, but they do it wisely.
They do. I think their scouting department deserves a heck of a lot of credit for the progress that their organization has made, just providing the fodder for these trades for their big league club. And of course, you know, a lot of the same scouts are there who drafted Chase Utley and Ryan Howard and Jimmy Rollins, Cole Hamels, that homegrown core that they have. JJ, you did. You know, we both talked to people a lot about that Florida State League pitching staff. May, Pettibone, Colvin, all were on that pitching staff. And then Juwan James was at Clearwater this year. You know, Juwan James, kind of a controversial prospect in a way, in that he almost didn't make this top 10. He was a late addition to the top 10. What's your take on this guy? I mean, you know, that's a pretty uninspiring year to make a top 10 off of with a sub-700 OPS. And he's 22 years old. I mean, I know it's a little bit of a different development path.
I was going to say, yeah, there's 2 years there that he lost because he was a pitcher and then he missed a year. But
do you still think of him as a potential impact guy, or is he more of an extra guy at this point?
I still think there's something there. And the reason I say that, for one of the things is that usually if you closed your eyes and I described a, you know, a prospect like Juwan James and you said he really offensively hasn't taken off, usually what you're going to say with that guy, the really athletic guy who played every sport, a little raw because of that in high, you know, played every sport in high school.
Right.
That guy, usually what you're going to say is okay, his pitch recognition is awful. He swings at everything that bounces, rolls, or goes over his head.
Right.
That's not Juwan James.
Right, that isn't. You're right.
What he has not been able to do is really kind of – and I do wonder with some of this – you know, we see the same thing. I can't help but think of Aaron Hicks. You got these guys who switch hit, and you wonder how much tougher is that making it for him because you have two swings to maintain.
That's a good point. I actually hadn't thought about that. He is – fairly comparable.
I mean, they had very similar seasons in the Florida State League.
Aaron Hicks was a pitcher in high school. He wasn't a pitcher in pro ball like Juwan James tried to be. But, yeah, that's interesting. I think Hicks' multi-sport was golf as opposed to basketball and football like it was for Juwan James.
I kind of wonder, like, Juwan James, there's been talk, you know, hey, would he be better off? There's been talk with Aaron Hicks also. Would he be better off just saying, you know what, we're not going to have you switch it anymore.
Right.
You know what, he's a lefty. Let's just let you hit lefty.
Yeah.
And see where it goes. Because I think part of when you see a guy like that, like Juwan James, like our scouting report says, he's a slap hitter from the right side.
Right.
Well, you're not going to hit for as much power. Even from your natural side, I think it's tougher to hit for power when half the time, but a third of the time you're at the plate, your approach is slap it and run.
And you're just not confident, and you know that that's not your best side. So I guess one of the other guys who got traded who's fallen off the prospect map a little bit because of injuries is Jason Knapp. That was another big-time prospect. You could make a representative top 10 just of their traded guys.
It would not rank 30th, I'll put it that way.
That's right. And you know, one of the guys they acquired in a trade to quote-unquote rebuild their farm system when they traded Cliff Lee was Philippe Aumont. And that's the guy, JJ, I have to say, if it were up to me, and if you just looked at the numbers, you'd never probably think of Philippe Aumont as a top 10 guy. But I talked to several scouts in the Eastern League when I did the EL. He didn't make my Eastern League top 20, but there are a couple guys who are like, don't sleep on that guy. Do not forget about Philippe Aumont. He still hasn't figured out the control, as I mentioned, command, but his stuff is sick. It's still there. It's still premium stuff. Premium sink. This is a guy I think a lot of scouts are convinced is going to figure it out and become a wipeout closer. And there's opportunity in that big league bullpen to set up in Philadelphia, but the closer spot's kind of now taken.
Yeah,
Jonathan Papelbon signing over there. So, but between Antonio Bastardo, Mike Stutes, some of the other young guys who've broken into that bullpen already, I think the Phillies are expecting Aumont to break in there and to break in there sooner than later. And he could still be the heir apparent to Papelbon. Justin DeFreitas is another guy I think who could break into that mix. But Aumont's the guy who's, I think, the high upside, high risk guy in their top 10, which I just don't think people think of him that way, but that's who he is now. Now we have the Nationals, JJ. This will be otherwise known as the Anthony Rendon debate.
Rendon.
Anthony Rendon. Thank you. Anthony Rendon is a whole other debate. Something about you and guys with the names that sound like that. You don't like either of those guys.
No, I don't like them, but...
You don't like them as much as others like them.
I have nothing personal against either of them.
You have personal animus for Anthony Rendon. Anthony Rendon killed your brother.
No.
He did not. He just can't throw to...
Well...
He hasn't thrown yet
in
a professional game.
He's our number two Nationals prospect. And my big concern...
And I would take their top three over the Braves' top three.
The reason I would not is that right now... I'm sorry. I'm concerned. He did not play. He did not play in the Fall League. The Fall League's not over yet, but it's over quick enough for me to say.
It's over in less than a week.
It's over in less than a week. He didn't play in the Fall League.
He's not going.
He's not going.
And when he was in the Instructional League, everybody thought that the Nationals told people when we asked about Anthony Rendon, he's not going to start in the Fall League, but he'll be there sooner than later, and he never showed up.
Which
they didn't want him to go if his arm wasn't fully healthy.
Which is, to me, a significant concern. Doesn't mean he's not a solid prospect and all, but here we're talking about a guy who really was never healthy his entire junior year of college.
Correct.
Who's had significant, you can call him fluke if you want, but he's been healthy in little bites.
No, he was healthy all his spring of his freshman year. He was healthy all his spring of his sophomore year.
Right.
The injuries were at the end of his freshman year in the postseason when he slid awkwardly, and then in the summer after his sophomore year when he was playing with USA Baseball.
Right.
It was the first week of playing that summer.
Right.
And then his junior year was affected throughout by this.
He played. I'll give him credit. He played with it, but he couldn't play in the field for the vast majority of the season.
Right, yeah. He played, one or two games in the conference tournament at second base.
And maybe this is just me being too conservative. I'm not saying that next year I could not see him being a top 10 prospect in all of baseball. But I'm just not ready to go there yet, because when you're talking about a guy who had a shoulder problem, which that shoulder problem has affected his hitting in some way too.
Yeah, this spring he didn't hit with the impact that he had previously. They had the new bats as well, but yes.
I want to see... I'll be a lot more comfortable. When we're doing our midseason prospect update, I may be a lot more comfortable on him than I am right now, but I need to see.
I think that's very reasonable, but I'd still take Harper, Rendon, and then Brad Peacock. I don't see what's so different about Brad Peacock.
Brad Peacock and Randall Delgado, to me, that's a pretty interchangeable.
I think the gap between Harper and Teron is bigger than the gap between Vizcaíno, who's probably a reliever, and Rendon.
Yeah,
that's the main point.
No,
I don't dispute that there is reason to have worry about Anthony Rendon. I don't dispute that one bit. I think all your points are very well made and very reasonable.
I'll agree with you. There's a gap from Harper to Teron. There's a significant.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty
big
gap.
And Teron's going to be, I feel comfortable in saying, probably a top. Well,
and I like Andrelton Simmons.
What's interesting, Teron, here's what's interesting. I don't think that Julio Teheran did almost anything this year, this past season, to diminish his prospect status.
I don't think so either.
That being said, depending on who gets posted and all, and Cespedes getting unblocked and all that, you could see him back up several spots in our top 100.
This is a good draft. So that's part
of it,
too.
You've got a good draft.
Yeah.
You've got Matt Moore basically doing a lot to help his prospect status. You have Harper and Trout doing nothing to hurt their prospect status.
Certainly not.
And then you add potentially some guys from Japan. You add,
I take Teron over Yoenis Cespedes.
Cespedes, but yeah.
I'm not sure which it is, to be honest.
Don't ask me.
I think it's Cespedes.
King of not pronouncing names properly. but the interesting thing is that top 10 is going to be there's going to be a whole lot of competition to make that top 10 this year.
There is.
Harper will be in it, though. I feel confident saying that.
I think
right
Harper's going to be in there. And
if he's not one, he'll be two. If he's not two, he'll be one.
I have a feeling that Jim Callis is going to have Anthony Rendon in his top 10. But obviously,
I will not have him in mind.
Obviously, Aaron Fitt not taking Anthony Rendon over Bryce Harper, as Jim Callis was wont to do in 2010, but did not do in 2011. The Nationals list, JJ, the other thing about it is that it's a real boom or bust top 10.
Right. This.
It's a high, high upside.
It's a high upside list. Now, let's be fair here. And we're both praising it. We think it's number one. I think it's number one, large part, because that guy who's sitting at number one on the list, Bryce Harper.
He's the biggest reason.
But this list, it's a better list But we've seen this before with the Nationals, where in hindsight we looked at it a couple of years later and went, you know, that list wasn't as good as we thought it was at the time, because there's a whole lot of, same as we saw a couple of years ago with their list, there's a whole lot of draftees who have yet to basically play pro ball.
Correct. And, I like Brian Goodwin. I like Alex Meyer. I like Matt Perk. All right. But there's a nice 5, 6, 7 right there when none of them play.
Right. Number 2, 5, 6, 7 do not have an official pro anywhere at bat.
Right. To me, Alex Meyer is a lot. There's a lot of similarities between Alex Meyer and Andrew Brackmann. That's damning him with faint praise right there. You know, I mean, Andrew Brackmann already set free by the Yankees. We knew that contract was trouble as soon as they signed Andrew Brackmann to that contract. And whether he would ever have lived up to – whether he would ever have made the big leagues on his own merits, you know, we don't know. He still might, but that contract was a killer. I mean, I can't blame him for getting his contract that paid him – he's probably gotten $9 million out of it so far, but, yeah, that's why he's not a Yankee right now at this point. But Alex Meyer is a similar player, a similar pitcher. He's big, and I think he's similarly athletic to Andrew Brackmann. I think that was the whole miscalculation with Brackmann, was just how athletic he is. To me, Alex Meyer is a reliever. I think, to me, the biggest, and I think Brian Goodwin, the big question is he going to be kind of a tweener left fielder without great power, or is he going to be good enough to play center field? The scouts I've talked to about him are very mixed. I do think he'll hit. He controlled the strike zone as a college freshman. He controlled it in the Cape Cod League. I do think that there's a chance that he could hit for some power. Will it be a left fielder or a center fielder? I think there's a chance he's a tweener.
And I'll say Matt Perk at number 7.
He's the biggest question.
That is the boom bust.
Yeah.
We were talking about Rendon. Whatever I just said about Rendon is times 10 when it comes to Perk.
Now, he at least did pitch in the fall league.
And that being said, though, the thing about it is that Perk did pitch in the fall league. And if Matt Perk is healthy, if Matt Perk goes back to being the Matt Perk that he was as a college freshman.
Right. And he's pretty good.
That's...
Or a high school senior when he was considered, when he was offered $4 million or more than that by the Texas Rangers.
That's a guy, I'll put it this way. I like, when you have him at number 7, number 7's a good spot for him.
Yeah, I agree.
Because number 7 is, the Nationals will not be devastated. They will not be, their entire plan will not fall apart if Matt Perk, they basically discover that, that Matt Perk that we used to know, he's gone.
Right.
We can't get him back.
And that might be the case with Matt Perk. His stuff was not great in the fall league, you know, more like 90, 91, 92 miles an hour. Had a couple of outings where he just got shellacked out there. Had another one where he was efficient. You know, had a 10-pitch, 1-2-3 inning out there. But like you said, he's not back to 2010, Matt Perk. And he may never get there. You know?
But if he does.
He may never get back to that Matt Perk. If he does.
But if he does, you spend a third-round pick on him and some money, that's a good risk.
Yeah, a lot of money.
A lot of money, but that's a much better. I can understand the risk in that. Like, if you have the money to spend, you're basically, you're saying we saw it and we think we can get it again.
Right, but I like their other pitchers in their list. I like AJ Cole. I like Sammy Solis. Derek Norris is intriguing. I keep saying it, the best 2-10 season in the minor leagues this year.
Derek Norris is,
he's weird.
It is fascinating. It is. He puts up. He puts up Mickey Tettleton, Gene Tennis seasons year after year.
Nice Mickey Tettleton reference. He's a little more athletic than Mickey.
But he puts up those seasons where it's like, oh, he had 222 this year?
And I had a scout.
Yeah, but, you know, it was with an 800 OPS.
That's right. And I love these. I had a scout after I did my Eastern League list. It was like, yeah, you know, you wrote about how he led the Eastern League in caught stealings, but I have a hunch that he caught a lot of fastballs. He said, like, it's more than a hunch. It's what I was told is he called a lot of fastballs when guys were on base, so his pitchers didn't always appreciate that he was throwing those guys out. So there's something to learn, and thankfully for the Nationals, they got their catcher back at the big league level with Wilson Ramos, who had his kidnapping scare in Venezuela, and we're all obviously thankful that Wilson Ramos, who you heard about first at Baseball America, ranked number 3 in the Twin system after the 2007 season. That was an aggressive ranking, if I do say so myself. I do wish that in hindsight he'd been number 1. But yeah. So I've always liked Wilson Ramos, and we've always had a little soft spot for him, and we're very glad that he's free.
Organization as a whole, I think we agree. There's a story in this issue that we just, you know, the NL East issue about this. There's a plan now. It's not just a plot. There's a plan.
There is a plan. It's a fully formed plan. And I don't know if the Jason Worth contract will stand in the way of their plan. It's going to be a negative. We probably could do a whole other podcast on this, JJ, but real quick, my challenge trade fantasy of the fall, if you're the Washington Nationals, would you trade Jason Worth? Would you offer Jason Worth for Carl Crawford straight up? Would you try to make that deal? I think that's a challenge trade that actually fits. I think Jason Worth fits better for the Boston Red Sox, and I think Carl Crawford fits better for the Washington Nationals.
I would rather have Crawford of those two, so I would say yes. I would make that offer because I would rather have Crawford.
And if I were Boston, I would rather have Worth because, A, Crawford was clearly shell-shocked than Boston, and B, I think Boston's lineup needs a right-handed power bat, and Jason Worth has proven he can be a nice complimentary piece, but he doesn't want to be the focal point, and I think Carl Crawford, no one else in Washington will be the focal point going forward after Steven Strasburg. He is the focal point. There'll be Bryce Harper.
There'll be two sons.
That's going to be a binary
system. And everything
system.
Else will revolve around them. Because
it's going to be like that crazy 2010. That illustration in the NFL preview issue in Sports Illustrated. Remember that ridiculous illustration with the two?
I was actually going with the 2010, where...
The movie.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, leave Europa to us.
Yes.
Isn't that what it says at the end?
Yeah,
I forget which
like
one
that.
It was.
Yeah.
I'm not a big enough fan of that of the 2001 and 2010. But yes, there was a binary system. I forgot all about
And no, I guess the other question with that is so how far away do you think Bryce Harper is?
I think he'll be in Washington like by June next year, if not a little bit sooner than that. And I think the big question is where do they play him? And I think early career, if they think his knees could take the pounding, I think he should be in center field. Because they don't have a big league center fielder. Jason Worth, contrary to Scott Boras' belief, cannot play center field. You might see Harper in right field and Worth playing center, and that will be ugly. But I guess if Rick Ankiel can play center field, Jason Worth certainly can.
Rick Ankiel's not that bad out
I'm
there.
Sure that Jason Worth would beat him in a foot race. I'm
I'll
sure
say,
he would
Rick
cover
Ankiel
the gaps.
Rick Ankiel can actually play some center. And Rick Ankiel is another guy who actually one of the few guys out there can say, "Hey, my arm can compare to."
Certainly,
too.
That's true. But yeah, I mean, I'm not sure where he played some left field in Double A, and he was outstanding at it. Seven outfield assists in like 36 games in the Eastern League. I'm all in on Bryce Harper, even after seeing him in the Rising Stars game, and he didn't look great. His batting practice made my ears ring. It's just ridiculous how
again, and
how
we also
the ball
we have to
off
we have
bat.
To remember.
What,
he'll play the entire 2012 season at 19.
So I think he'll be in the big leagues. I think he'll be in the big leagues at 19, and I think he'll be fine in the big leagues, and I think he'll star in 2013. So I would make that deal, and if I were – I think that's my favorite challenge trade in baseball. Two overpriced giant flop outfielders who I think fit better on the other in the other city. And especially when you have a compliant, a press that really cares much more about everything else going on in Washington other than the baseball team, and where the Redskins are still king. The only time the media seems to pay attention in Washington to the Nationals is Strasburg and
Harper. It's gonna change a little bit now because they're for one, they are gonna be better.
I think so.
Let's be fair. There's been a whole lot of time. There hasn't been a reason to pay attention to the Nationals.
You mean you weren't paying attention when Rob Dibble was their color analyst? No,
but now they're not only exciting because a Strasburg starts exciting, but they have the basis of rotation.
I love the fact that Strasburg's salary is slated to be their fourth highest next year.
It's well deserved.
Yeah, well, it's Worth, Zimmerman, and then Adam LaRoche. I kind of forgot about that guy. Wow, I forgot they had that guy. $8 million for next year.
It's a young team. There is the basis there of a lot of potential. One other thing with Rendon is that, and we also not that he probably can't handle, but we need to see he's going to be healthy, and we need to see that he can handle second base.
It would certainly help because Ryan Zimmerman's pretty good at third base.
He's not playing third base for the Nationals, barring an injury.
Yeah, no, you're right. And the time to move Ryan Zimmerman to shortstop has long since passed. They missed their window of opportunity there.
Which is actually not that bad because...
No, he's pretty awesome at third base.
Right.
But they didn't miss out on anything. JJ and John Manuel will be back with you next time with a National League Central podcast. But like we said, in the interim, we're going to have a draft podcast.
Well, actually, I don't know. Now I think about it. I don't know if the Connor Nathan one, they may podcast. But since we're doing another draft podcast this week,
we're certainly going to do one.
We're definitely doing one draft podcast.
At least one, if not another.
And then we'll have a Central coming up. before long. We'll have a Rule 5, I'm sure, at some point.
We'll have winter meetings podcast. Yes, we will have a Rule 5. I don't know if we'll do a Rule 5 preview. We might do a Rule 5 preview podcast.
We probably will. Let's be honest.
It depends on how the rest of the handbook is going. So much more to come as the offseason progresses here at Baseball America with the podcast. For JJ Cooper, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you next time on the Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.